What's up, everybody? Hope you're all fantastic. We're continuing our look back at some of the memorable sequels from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I recently did videos on both great sequels to classic 80s movies and on sequels from great 80s movies that I think completely failed. I'll leave those both linked here for you guys to check out if you're interested. But today we're stepping back into the 1970s. Cinema hadn't quite boomed at this point in time, but it was on the rise. There were a ton of memorable releases, many of which had great sequels. So in this video, I'm diving into 10 awesome sequels from great movies released during the 1970s. Back in 1976, a boxing match would go the distance when a raw, up-and-coming fighter would take on the world champ in Rocky, an award-winning, critical, and financial hit with a behind-the-scenes story as awesome as the in-the-ring story on the screen. 3 years later, Balboa and Creed would lock up in the rematch of the century in Rocky II, with Stallone taking over the directing duties. Rocky II didn't reach the same critical acclaim as the first, but it was well-received, and there was still that intricacy in the emotional elements of the story in the hands of Stallone's direction that made the movie a solid follow-up in the underdog story of Rocky Balboa. Stallone would eventually take the series to much more superficial and flashy levels in parts 3 and 4, but 2 still holds up as one of the better films in the franchise when relying on the dramatic layering of the character arcs. It delivers all the training montages and in-ring action you'd want from a boxing flick, but to me, Rocky II was a movie that really thrived during the quiet moments between all the action, with Rocky navigating his life outside of the ring with Adrian and with Mickey and a new baby, and while Weathers was shining as well as Creed on the counter side of the plot, just hell-bent on getting his redemption with a clean win. And to me, Rocky II still holds up as one of the better films in this long-lasting franchise. Ridley Scott would deliver a sci-fi horror masterpiece with 1979's Alien. In would come director James Cameron, and 7 years later, like he would do with the Terminator franchise, he would take a dark and gritty smaller film and use it to create a blockbuster action sequel with Aliens in 1986, a movie that, like Terminator 2, would raise the cinematic spectacle to awesome levels. Now, to me, the first two Alien and Terminator movies almost mirror one another in style. If you want a gritty, claustrophobic, sci-fi horror thriller, then Alien is a go-to. If you want that exact same atmosphere, but instead served as a big, tough, macho action adventure, then Aliens is the film to see, because Cameron took this small concept and turned it into a massive, large-scale action thriller with endless memorable moments and just a buffet of unnerving suspense and high-octane action. I love the cast in this sequel. I love the practical effects. I love the grimy production design and just the immaculate direction from Cameron. Plus, this sequel sticks the landing perfectly. I think the closing to this 2 hour plus long spectacle ride is just delightfully satisfying, with Ripley in her exosuit just battling the xenomorph one-on-one. Many people consider this to be a better film, and while that is up for debate, I certainly think it's an incredible film that succeeds on every level as a sequel. The Man of Steel would make his big screen debut in 1978's Superman. It was extremely well received. Now, there was always intended to be a sequel for the Caped Hero, since these two movies were shot simultaneously, and after some director issues, Richard Donner, with about 75% of his sequel shot, would be fired. Richard Lester would come in, and Superman 2 would be released in 1980. Growing up, I was definitely a Superman 2 kid. I watched this movie so many times. I loved the humor as a kid, and the villainous trio of Zod, Ursa, and Non were a perfect counter to Superman. The sequel was shot with the first film. There was a highly publicized change in directors, but it doesn't hurt the finished product, in my opinion. I think both Donner and Lester's directorial visions, for the most part, blend well enough to keep the continuity in this film. As an adult, the humor does get a bit too slapstick, but overall, I still love the just comic book world that this movie captures. The pace is tighter than the original, the action is more imposing and more harrowing. It's a cliche to say, but I mean, Superman 2 just kind of feels like the pages of a comic book playing out on the big screen with just enough camp to complement the melodrama, and when the finale kicks in with Superman battling Zod in Metropolis, the results can still put a smile on my face and harken back to the kid inside of me who just loved the Man of Steel. John Carpenter's Halloween would introduce a new icon to the horror genre while also giving the genre what many people consider to be a horror masterpiece. It was natural a sequel would come. Carpenter essentially refused to direct and appointed the duties to Rick Rosenthal, and in 1981, Halloween 2 would be released, continuing the story of Laurie Strode and Michael Myers. This was another sequel growing up that I again preferred over the first. I know the first is a horror classic and its slow plotting and methodical pacing is intentional, but personally I just slightly prefer this sequel. I enjoy the tighter pacing, I like the increased body count and the action that it brings, I like the elevated slasher vibe and the hospital settings and all the confined tension that comes from the shadows of this movie. Plus, Myers just has more to do and I've always loved it. This film was naturally not as favorable with the critics, but when looking back at all the terrible Halloween sequels that would come over the years, Halloween 2 may not be as traditionally good as the first, but it is a worthy contender that I think would have held up much better over time had the series just died at the end of this film with Strode and Myers closing out their battle. But when going back to revisit the franchise each season, I always watch the first film simply to set up the enjoyable terror that this sequel delivers. To say 1977 Star Wars was a revolutionary cinematic experience would be a bit of an understatement. Years would slowly tick by, paving the way for the most anticipated sequel of all time. The pressure and the expectations for this movie were through the roof, and when The Empire Strikes Back would be released in 1980, it would end up being one of the greatest sequels of all time. Now, I love all three of the original Star Wars films, but The Empire Strikes Back was hands down my favorite as a kid. I had this movie on VHS. I would watch it almost every Saturday and Sunday morning with my cereal early in the morning before going out to play with my friends. There was really so much pressure on this sequel to succeed, and not only did it live up to the high bar set from the first, it just knocked it out of the park with bigger, more adrenaline-pumping action sequences, much higher stakes, more awesome new characters, incredible world-building, and all the same old charm from the core group of characters to make for a sequel that went bigger and better in all the ways you could hope for. Now, I've always felt like the Star Wars movies were a little bit too talky, even as an adult, but what I loved about The Empire Strikes Back was that it was just much more engaging. It was a bit more higher energy with a great balance between the heroes and the villains. This sequel didn't just ride the coattails of the first. It built its own legitimacy and would end up being, in my opinion, the best sequel ever made. In 1971, Shaft would be released, starring Richard Roundtree as a private detective that men wanted to be and women wanted to be with. It was a modest hit, pulling in $13 million on a $500,000 budget, so a sequel would come one year later in 1972's Shaft Big Score, a follow-up that ramped up the action, elevated the energy, and totally dialed up the style. I remember growing up, I had this friend whose parents both had great jobs. They had a nice house, they had all the new release snacks that you could actually sit on the couch and eat while watching commercials for them, which was a completely new concept to me. They had that gigantic 80s and 90s entertainment system, and they were definitely movie geeks because they had quite the little VCR bootlegging racket going on there. Home collection of movies in the converted hall closet was just a treasure trove of titles from literally every genre, and in their collection was the Shaft movies, and my favorite of them all was Shaft's Big Score. The original was okay. I appreciate its slow burn, crime procedural pacing much more as an adult, but as a kid, Shaft's Big Score had it all. It had cool music, big action, style, endless sex appeal that made it feel like an action movie that we shouldn't have been watching as a kid. Then front and center was Richard Roundtree as Shaft, a smooth talker that was never in over his head, and I still think this sequel is my favorite in the Roundtree Shaft era. Clint Eastwood would step into an iconic character when he would play the grizzled cop Harry Callahan in 1971's Dirty Harry. The film was a hit, so a couple of years later in 1973, Eastwood would grab his .44 Magnum revolver once again to take on vigilante cops in the follow-up sequel, Magnum Force. I never watched this movie completely through until my college years, but it was one that I remembered seeing playing on the TV as a kid. What stood out to little me at the time was the motorcycle cops being the villains and how post-direction would often frame the characters without their faces in view, which really just hit me with an eerie vibe as a kid. Watching it later, I wouldn't say I like it better than Dirty Harry, but I do appreciate the added style to Magnum Force. You get all the tough as nails, anti-authority gusto from Eastwood, but you also get elevated stunt work, more elaborate camera angles, and action sequences that hit a little harder than they did in Dirty Harry. This group of vigilante cops in action are menacing enough. They're a little thin on the writing side, but they work for a sequel that repeats what was successful from the first while really only elevating the polish. It's like the same Cadillac, but with a new great wax job that just kind of makes driving the same old car feel new again. This was one of those cases where a sequel would turn a franchise into a global success. When Mad Max was released in 1979, it would find success as a gritty independent film out of Australia, but when Mad Max 2, known to many as The Road Warrior, would be released in 1981, it would turn the character of Mad Max into an action icon for years to come. Mad Max is an iconic flick, but I think most would agree The Road Warrior is a masterclass in practical action and thrilling stunt work that just took the character to legendary, wide, worldwide commercial levels of appeal. The sequel took a small indie film and turned it into a global franchise. It's filled with wildly eccentric characters and bold performances, led by Mel Gibson, who is just a complete badass, Lord Humongous, and Wes lead a delightfully sadistic crew of villains, and the pace is really dialed up to breakneck speed. But what sets this movie apart is the massive action set pieces that still look as visually exciting here in 2025 as they did back in 1981. I watched this movie so many times when I was a kid. I loved the amusement park ride of carnage that it delivers, and it's still able to kind of thrive on its foreboding intention and its ominous atmosphere. And where many sequels hope to simply succeed, The Road Warrior, with its nonstop action and suspense, was a sequel that turned the character of Mad Max into an action legend in cinema. Now, Star Trek had long been a staple for television audiences. By the time Star Trek the Motion Picture would be released in 1979, it was a critical and financial success for the most part, so there was no doubt that a sequel would come. But when Star Trek II The Wrath of Khan would be released, its popularity would quickly surpass the original and go down as the most well-known film in the franchise. Now, I've never been a huge sci-fi fantasy fan. I, of course, loved Star Wars growing up. I never really got into Star Trek, despite episodes of that playing on the TV and the backdrop is like a fabric of my childhood and teenage years. But with that said, I really did enjoy this follow-up sequel that audiences and critics seem to enjoy more than the first. The Wrath of Khan was the Star Trek movie I remember watching so many times growing up as a kid. Those creatures that went into your ear just freaked me out. I remember Ricardo Montalban's performance being imposingly menacing as a kid, and it has slowly morphed into being kind of comically menacing as an adult. And overall, I just enjoyed this adventure. I think the stakes that were on the line really give the plot a hard-hitting set of ramifications that kind of completely locked me in as a kid, really. The Wrath of Khan has all the familiar faces in place. It counters this with a world-class villain in Khan. It just makes this sci-fi adventure a complete package. The movie never turned me into a Trekkie, but it is my favorite movie in the Shatner Nimoy film series. I think everybody would pretty much agree that Cheech and Chong are the godfathers of the buddy stoner comedy, and their rolling out film Up in Smoke from 1978 was a relative success, so the fun-loving duo would hit the screen once again in 1980 with Cheech and Chong's next movie, a sequel that may not have been as good as Up in Smoke, but one that still delivers a ton of laughs. I remember an older brother of a buddy of mine had a few of the Cheech and Chong movies on VHS. This was one of them, and as a kid, I really loved it, even though I really had no idea what I was exactly watching. I knew it was crude and edgy. It just made me laugh, even though most of the jokes went right over my head until I was in high school. I wouldn't say I prefer this sequel over Up in Smoke, but I still love the comical absurdity of the story. This movie's like a comical carnival sideshow, and I think it's a blast. The jokes are firing much quicker in this movie, and just the over-the-top silliness of it all still cracks me up as an adult. I love Cheech and Chong. I love their chemistry. I think it's so natural, as is their comedic timing. And sure, this sequel kept the same themes, but it certainly did its own thing. It's wild, it's absurd, it's raunchy and splashes, yet it's all lined with quick-witted and just a clever sense of humor that makes it dumb fun at its finest. And that's it for this video, guys. Here are my picks for 10 great sequels to some awesome movies to come out of the 70s. Now that I'm saying this, I realize I completely forgot The Godfather, but I will be doing a sequel video to this one as well. I will definitely get it in on the next round. I hope you guys have been enjoying this little trip down sequel memory lane. If you have some picks that are in your mind that I haven't mentioned, put them down in the comments. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts. Thank you so much, as always, for watching. You guys are all fantastic. I appreciate each and every one of your viewership. It means the world to me. Hope to see you guys all back in my next video coming real soon. And until then, movies never say die. I just couldn't do it, guys. I couldn't close out this video without talking about The Godfather Part 2. I had a complete brain fart and forgot all about this movie somehow until I was almost done editing this video. And I felt it was a must to come back and add it to the list. The Godfather Part 2 is both a prequel and a sequel, and it's arguably the best sequel of all time. I know just earlier I said The Empire Strikes Back was, but as I said, my old age is creeping up on me, and this one almost slipped through the cracks. But as a film and a sequel, I would have to place The Godfather 2 as the superior film. This movie tells two stories, all within one overarching narrative, and it's as riveting as 3.5 hours of cinema can actually be. I think the performances from Pacino and De Niro, and really everybody, is flawless, as is the writing, the scoring, the direction, the production design. I think the balance of character arcs is seamless, with pristine filmmaking at every level. I think The Godfather 2 is a world-class pre-sequel and the pinnacle of mafia movies.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?
Now, sequels to great movies often fail to live up to their predecessors. Many simply try to relive the same magic by repeating the process, and I recently did a video covering 10 movies I consider to be failed sequels to iconic movies from the 80s. I'll leave it linked here for you guys to check out later if you missed it, but today I have 10 movies that I consider to be great follow-ups to great movies, sequels that may not have been as good as their predecessors, yet ones that were able to deliver plenty of entertainment on their own to justify their existence. So, let's get into it. The Naked Gun from the files of the Police Squad would charm audiences in 1988, and 3 years later, slapstick comedy legend Leslie Nielsen would reprise his role as Lieutenant Frank Drebin in 1991's The Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear, a movie that would bring plenty of new laughs, plenty of new characters, and would end up surpassing the box office success of the first. To me, The Naked Gun is one of the best spoof comedies of all time, so coming up with the worthy sequel would be a tall task. One, The Naked Gun 2.5 would knock out of the park, in my opinion. I still slightly prefer the first movie, but this sequel was without question able to carry right along with all the silly and absurd humor without skipping a beat. This movie just brings you right back into that same cartoon world, and all the familiar characters are back and just landing top-tier absurd humor with precision mentioned, Leslie Nielsen is the godfather of slapstick spoof humor to me. I consider him to be the gold standard, and he's just an absolute riot in this movie from start to finish. I think Robert Goulet serves up a great villain. This movie has silly drama, light action, and it's nonstop laughs. And sure, it repeats the formula, but that's pretty much the point in this genre. The Naked Gun 2.5 just brings back all the clever charm that the first script was filled with. I've watched this movie so many times, and when pairing it with the first movie, they really just seem together like one long film. Raiders of the Lost Ark would turn the character of Indiana Jones into an 80s icon. The movie would deliver a crowd-pleasing adventure. It would pull in a ton of cash as well. So 3 years later, Harrison Ford would don the hat and whip once again for Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, a movie that would deliver another great adventure and prove to be a divisive sequel for decades, with some people loving it and others feeling it was a step down. Now, I'm probably one of the few who actually liked The Temple of Doom over Raiders, but as a kid, this was the movie for me, and as an adult, while Raiders is the critically more sounder film, I think the over-the-top, fast-paced insanity of this movie just lures me in every time. Ford's having a great time in the character, and Short Round certainly does make up for Capshaw's shortcomings, and I just really love the mood of this movie. I love the backdrops and the adventures and all the exotic locations. I enjoy how the humor is slightly elevated and just worked into many of the action sequences, and really every sequel is going to try to go bigger and better, and it doesn't always work in Temple of Doom, but to me there is just an added confidence to the plot and the tone of this movie that allows it to go slightly more full throttle. And while it may be a little bit more superficial than Raiders of the Lost Ark, this movie is still my favorite Indiana Jones movie. Now, back in 1986, a little action thriller about a special effects expert being framed for a crime called FX would come and go with little movement on the financial needle, but it was appreciated by fans of the genre, and it would have a great run on the home video market. So 6 years after its release, Brian Brown and Brian Dennehy would prove that two Brians do make a right when they would return to investigate a murder in 1991's FX2. You know, I'm not sure what it is, but it seemed like a lot of sequels were just on heavier cable TV rotation growing up, because I remember seeing this sequel much more than the first. Now, FX2 is not as good as FX. It naturally loses its pop of originality. It does get a little bit too cute with some of the gadgetry, and it does focus on more tried and true, fast-paced plotting, but it still manages to result in a strong sequel that does repeat many of the ingredients, but still shows plenty of effort in bringing new, unique elements to the table that all fit within the special effects theme of this franchise. I love the performances from the Bryans in this movie. They've been elevated to a buddy duo, and while it has been done before, it still manages to work for this underrated sequel that delivers plenty of clever action set pieces and a satisfying finale that just kind of feels like a perfect closing for a movie like this, where special effects and movie-making technology can be used like a cross between 007 and MacGyver with a splash of Lethal Weapon to solve a crime. Beverly Hills Cop was a smash hit for Eddie Murphy in 1984 with a blend of action, humor, and character charm that audiences loved. 3 years later, Murphy would return as Axel Foley. The budget would be increased, the action and the humor would be ramped up as well, and Tony Scott would direct, making 1987's Beverly Hills Cop 2 the highest grossing release of the entire franchise and a full-throttle commercial action comedy that still maintains its entertainment value today. The first thing that pops with this sequel is the noticeable style and sleekness in the direction from Tony Scott. It does make this movie feel like a much bigger and grander action flick, and I love the atmosphere this sequel is able to deliver while still actually feeling like it's set in the same world with the same vibe as the first movie. There's just an entertaining balance in Beverly Hills Cop 2 between it being a Tony Scott film and an Eddie Murphy action comedy. Jürgen Prochnow and Brigitte Nielsen as the villains, I think, are nicely cast. Prochnow has a menacing demeanor that's perfect for a movie bad guy, and a sexy 6-foot-tall blonde making taking people out with no hesitation is really just peak 80s action attitude. There's still plenty of Murphy charm and comedic banter between he, Reinhold, and Ashton. The plot of avenging Captain Bogomil is perfect revenge fuel, and with Scott behind the camera, the action feels bigger, more elaborate, and much more intense to make this a very worthy sequel. To me, 1987's Predator is one of the best action movies ever made, with the ultimate ensemble of badasses led by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Usually when the leading star of a film does not return for the sequel, the result is often a huge miss, and while not as legendary as its predecessor, 1990's Predator 2, featuring Danny Glover in a sweltering Los Angeles backdrop, would turn out to be a solid action thriller, even if it fails to hold a torch to the first. Some knock this movie when comparing it to the original, and I think Predator is pretty much a perfect movie that had all the right ingredients in place to make something extraordinary out of a relatively simple concept, so the likelihood of Predator 2 being as good or better was really a 10 million to 1 shot, so trying to compare the two only gets in the way of just appreciating the entertainment value that this movie does have. Now, it's far from as good as the first, but it's still able to bring plenty of unique elements to the table to actually warrant its existence. I mean, even if Predator never existed, Predator 2 would be a solid action sci-fi thriller loaded with gritty action, strong performances, spots of suspense, endless bravado, and a great ensemble cast. I think the LA settings here are a cool playground for all the violence and hunting from the Predator, and I think this movie is a great ride. Plus, the practical effects and makeup work are still in place like the first film, so despite all the years, the cunning Predator still looks better than the partially digital one we just recently got in Prey. Now, I think everybody would agree that Chucky is an icon of the horror genre with his twisted Krueger-esque sense of humor and his murderous gusto. 1988's Child's Play is a strong origin story, and horror films are essentially guaranteed a sequel. 1990's Child's Play 2 would be free of the origin constraints. It would escalate the body count and the intensity to result in a sophomore killing spree from Chucky that I sort of enjoy more than the first. Now, I've always loved this movie. I think it's a great sequel. The first Child's Play is certainly a solid horror flick, but it does have a slower pace, and the origin story kind of gets in the way just a little of the sadistic killing fun. I mean, Child's Play 2 just gives Chucky much more to do, and it's a blast of twisted mayhem and campy horror tension. Chucky really comes into his own in this sequel. He's dropping memorable lines and cementing himself as a comedic contender to Freddy Krueger in the horror genre. And while this movie does navigate through all the genre cliches, it just leans into them nicely. It does them right. And the result to me is just a fast-paced ride of delightful violence. I watched this movie on cable over so many weekends growing up. I love the toy factory backdrop. The scenes at the school are fun as well. This sequel gave Chucky ample one-liners, plenty of memorable kills, and it's still my favorite movie in the Chucky franchise. Now, many people would consider 1984's The Terminator as being one of the classic sci-fi action thrillers out there, with Arnold's imposing performance as the relentless T-800 being stuff of legend. 7 years would pass, filmmaking technology would boom, Arnold would become a good robot, and Terminator 2 Judgment Night would be released in 1991, changing the game of cinema. It's really a perfect sequel and a film that, on its own, has stood the test of time as being a cinematic masterpiece. Many would say Terminator 2 is a better film than the first, and I would say it's hard to argue that. However, I also think they both serve their purpose perfectly for their intention. Terminator was a smaller, grittier, darker sci-fi action thriller and a great one. Terminator 2 is a four-quadrant commercial blockbuster and a fantastic one as well. This movie is really just a complete cinematic package. The visual effects are still crisp all these years later, and the result is a non-stop ride of action spectacle. Arnold plays the good guy this round, and his performance here is easily one of his most iconic. This film would just command the box offices. Audiences loved it. And it was because it was able to take that concept of the first and use it as a great seed for thought-provoking world building that can easily sweep you up. This is one of those movies I can remember watching and coming out of the theater and all of us just being in awe of what we just watched. And even if you've seen it a bunch of times, that feeling can kind of still hit you after watching this movie today. To me, Lethal Weapon is the best buddy cop movie ever to hit the silver screen. The movie was well received by critics, by audiences, it made a good amount of money. Thus, a sequel was inevitable, and when Lethal Weapon 2 would drop into theaters in 1989, it would prove to be a follow-up film that built off the success of the first while growing the friendship between its main characters and building a clever plot and ramping up the action, essentially writing the great sequel playbook along the way. I really think Lethal Weapon 2 was able to flip the notions of a sequel. This one repeats essentially everything that worked in the first movie, but at the same time is able to kind of do its own new thing. This movie spends much more time developing the friendship between Murtaugh and Riggs, but is still able to weave these character dynamics into tried and true criminal plotting that just serves up ample opportunities for high energy, practical action. Lethal Weapon 2 was really able to just pick up that same atmosphere of the original, and despite it feeling like a wash and repeat plot, it's an interesting and engaging plot as Riggs and Murtaugh battle a villain with diplomatic immunity, plus it adds the comical character of Leo Getz, played perfectly by Joe Pesci, who's able to just come in with Gibson and Glover to make for a charming trio. Lethal Weapon 2 knows that if it isn't broke, don't fix it, and it rides once again on the genuine chemistry between Gibson and Glover to make it a very worthy sequel. Now, The Living Daylights is like the 15th James Bond movie, but it's the first that would feature Timothy Dalton in the leading role. It was another entertaining entry in the franchise, and 2 years later, in 1989, Dalton would return for a sequel that I think was better than his coming out party in the delightfully eccentric and gusto-filled License to Kill, a sequel that stands on its own as a fun, slightly campy espionage action adventure with a perfect touch of grittiness. I'm not sure if this was the first Bond movie I ever watched, but it was definitely the Bond movie I remember watching countless times as a kid. License to Kill is just filled with killer stunt work, resulting in a ton of visually appealing action sequences. Then you get the suave charm of Dalton as Bond, who I really liked. Then you get Robert Davi just playing up a great villain. To me, License to Kill is a fantastic blend of 80s action and 007. It's a bit silly at times. There's a campy eccentricity to this movie as well, and it actually gets pretty violent. You have a villain who feeds his enemies to sharks. Del Toro gets shredded in a brick grinder, and when the violence hits, it's kind of comically over the top. The dialogue is filled with amusing bravado and memorable lines and comical self-seriousness. And when all is said and done, License to Kill, despite its flaws, is a fantastic sequel with action that still looks awesome and a James Bond that was just riding at peak virility. While it did have a lot of action, 1982's First Blood, to me at least, plays much more like a psychological thriller with a heaviness to all the emotion. All of that substance would be thrown out the window when Stallone would reprise his role in 1985's Rambo First Blood Part 2, resulting in what would become a quintessential 80s action flick, a sequel that would deliver excess at every level, propel the character of Rambo into an 80s icon, and just rake in cash at the summer box office. I definitely remember seeing Rambo 2 as a kid before I watched First Blood. I think I even remember seeing Rambo 3 a few times before as well. I loved Rambo as a kid. I watched the cartoons. I had my own adventures out in the woods behind my house. I had the action figures, my own survival knife, and I could not get enough of this movie. It's far more superficial than First Blood, but its excessive, ultra-explosive action is what makes Rambo 2 a textbook 80s action movie. It's a quintessential one-man army movie. Stallone is absolutely jacked and at peak badass, just taking dudes out in a variety of ways, from stealthy missions to shootouts to awesome close quarter takedowns and endless explosions. Rambo 2 knows to survive a war, you need to become war, and it tops it off with a helicopter showdown as the cherry on the sundae, making it a sequel that took a small concept and turned it into a larger-than-life action franchise and one of the most iconic franchises from the 80s. And that's it for this video today, guys. These are 10 movies I consider to be great sequels to already classic 80s movies that are still a great time to sit back and watch here in good old 2025. Thank you guys so much for watching. As always, I hope you guys have enjoyed this video. Let me know what some of your picks are for some great sequels or some sequels that were better than their first films. I'd love to hear your guys' picks on those. Again, thank you guys all so much for all your viewership. You guys make this so much fun. Be on the lookout for my next video coming real soon. And until then, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war. You gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?